Critias by Plato, an adult brain audiobook production, read by Graham Dunlop. Critias, persons of the dialogue, Critias, Hermocrates, Timaeus, Socrates, Timaeus. How thankful I am, Socrates, that I have arrived at last, and like a weary traveler after a long journey, may be at rest. And I pray the being who always was of old, and has now been by me revealed, to grant that my words may endure in so far as they have been spoken truly and acceptably to him. But if unintentionally I have said anything wrong, I pray that he will impose upon me a just retribution. And the just retribution of him who errs is that he should be set right. Wishing, then, to speak truly in future concerning the generation of the gods, I pray him to give me knowledge, which of all medicines is the most perfect and best. And now, having offered my prayer, I deliver up the argument to Critias, who is to speak next according to our agreement. Critias. And I, Timaeus, accept the trust. And as you at first said that you were going to speak of high matters, and beg that some forbearance might be shown to you, I too ask the same or greater forbearance for what I am about to say. And although I very well know that my request may appear to be somewhat and discourteous, I must make it nevertheless. Or will any man of sense deny that you have spoken well? I can only attempt to show that I ought to have more indulgence than you, because my theme is more difficult, and I shall argue that to seem to speak well of the gods to men is far easier than to speak well of men to men. For the inexperience and utter ignorance of his hearers about any subject is a great assistance to him who has to speak of it, and we know how ignorant we are concerning the gods. But I should like to make my meaning clear, if Timaeus, you will follow me. All that is said by any of us can only be imitation and representation. For if we consider the likenesses which painters make of bodies divine and heavenly, and the different degrees of gratification with which the eye of the spectator receives them, we shall see that we are satisfied with the artist who is able in any degree to imitate the earth and its mountains, and the rivers and the woods and the universe, and the things that are and move therein. And further, that knowing nothing precise about such matters, we do not examine or analyze the painting. All that is required is a sort of indistinct and deceptive mode of shadowing them forth. But when a person endeavors to paint the human form, we are quick at finding out defects, and our familiar knowledge makes us severe judges of anyone who does not render every point of similarity. And we may observe the same thing to happen in discourse. We are satisfied with a picture of divine and heavenly things which has very little likeness to them, but we are more precise in our criticism of mortal and human things. Wherefore, if at the moment of speaking I cannot suitably express my meaning, you must excuse me, considering that to form approved likenesses of human things is the reverse of easy. This is what I want to suggest to you, and at the same time to beg, Socrates, that I may have not less, but more indulgence conceded to me in what I am about to say, which favor, if I am right in asking, I hope that you will be ready to grant. Socrates.
Certainly, Critias, we will grant your request, and we will grant the same by anticipation to Hermocrates, as well as to you and Timaeus. For I have no doubt that when his turn comes a little while hence, he will make the same request which you have made. In order, then, that he may provide himself with a fresh beginning, and not be compelled to say the same things over again, let him understand that the indulgence is already extended by anticipation to him. And now, friend Critias, I will announce to you the judgment of the theater. They are of the opinion that the last performer was wonderfully successful, and that you will need a great deal of indulgence before you will be able to take his place.
Hermocrates.
The warning, Socrates, which you have addressed to him, I must also take to myself. But remember, Critias, That faint heart never yet raised a trophy, and therefore you must go and attack the argument like a man. First invoke Apollo and the Muses, and then let us hear you sound the praises and show forth the virtues of your ancient citizens.
Critias, friend Hermocrates, you who are stationed last and have another in front of you, have not lost heart as yet. The gravity of the situation will soon be revealed to you. Meanwhile, I accept your exhortations and encouragements. But besides the gods and goddesses whom you have mentioned, I would specially invoke Mnemosyne, for all the important part of my discourse is dependent on her favor. And if I can recollect and recite enough of what was said by the priests and brought hither by Solon, I doubt not that I shall satisfy the requirements of this theater. And now, making no more excuses, I will proceed. Let me begin by observing, first of all, that 9,000 was the sum of years which had elapsed since the war which was said to have taken place between those who dwelt outside the pillars of Heracles and all who dwelt within them. This war I am going to describe. Of the combatants on the one side, the city of Athens was reported to have been the leader and to have fought out the war. The combatants on the other side were commanded by the kings of Atlantis, which, as I was saying, was an island greater in extent than Libya and Asia, and when afterwards sunk by an earthquake, became an impassable barrier of mud to voyagers sailing from hence to any part of the ocean. The progress of the history will unfold the various nations of barbarians and families of Hellenes which then existed, as they successively appear on the scene. But I must describe, first of all, Athenians of that day, and their enemies who fought with them, and then the respective powers and governments of the two kingdoms. Let us give the precedence to Athens. In the days of old, the gods had the whole earth distributed among them by allotment. There was no quarreling, for you cannot rightly suppose that the gods did not know what was proper for each of them to have, or, knowing this, that they would seek to procure for themselves by contention that which more properly belonged to others. They all of them, by just apportionment, obtained what they wanted and peopled their own districts. And when they had peopled them, they tended us, their nurslings and possessions, as shepherds tend their flocks, excepting only that they did not use blows or bodily force as shepherds do, but governed us like pilots from the stern of the vessel, which is an easy way of guiding animals, holding our souls by the rudder of persuasion according to their own pleasure. Thus did they guide all mortal creatures. Now different gods had their allotments in different places which they set in order. Hephaestus and Athene, who were brother and sister and sprang from the same father, having a common nature, and being united also in the love of philosophy and art, both obtained as their common portion this land, which was naturally adapted for wisdom and virtue. And there they implanted brave children of the soil, and put into their minds the order of government. Their names are preserved, but their actions have disappeared by reason of the destruction of those who received the tradition, and the lapse of ages. For when there were any survivors, as I have already said, they were men who dwelt in the mountains, and they were ignorant of the art of writing, and had heard only the names of the chiefs of the land, but very little about their actions. The names they were willing enough to give to their children, but the virtues and the laws of their predecessors they knew only by obscure traditions. And as they themselves and their children lacked for many generations the necessaries of life, they directed their attention to the supply of their wants. And of them they conversed, to the neglect of events that had happened in times long past. For mythology and the inquiry into antiquity are first introduced into cities when they begin to have leisure, and when they see that the necessaries of life have already been provided, but not before. And this is reason why the names of the ancients have been preserved to us and not their actions. This I infer because Solon said that the priests in their narrative of that war mentioned most of the names which are recorded prior to the time of Theseus, such as Cecrops, and Erechtheus, and Erechthonius, and Erisichthon, and the names of the women in like manner. Moreover, since military pursuits were then common to men and women, the men of those days, in accordance with the custom of the time, set up a figure and image of the goddess in full armor, to be a testimony that all animals which associate together, male as well as female, may, if they please, practice in common the virtue which belongs to them without distinction of sex. Now the country was inhabited in those days by various classes of citizens. There were artisans, and there were husbandmen, and there was also a warrior class originally set apart by divine men. The latter dwelt by themselves, and had all things suitable for nurture and education. Neither had any of them anything of their own, but they regarded all that they had as common property. Nor did they claim to receive of the other citizens anything more than their necessary food. And they practiced all the pursuits which we yesterday described as those of our imaginary guardians. Concerning the country, the Egyptian priests said what is not only probable but manifestly true, that the boundaries were in those days fixed by the isthmus, and that in the direction of the continent they extended as far as the heights of Cithaeron and Parnes. The boundary line came down in the direction of the sea, having the district of Oropus on the right, and with the river Asopus as the limit on the left. The land was the best in the world, and was therefore able in those days to support a vast army raised from the surrounding people. Even the remnant of Attica, which now exists, may compare with any region in the world for the variety and excellence of its fruits, and the suitableness of its pastures to every sort of animal, which proves what I am saying. But in those days the country was fair as now, and yielded far more abundant produce. How shall I establish my words? And what part of it can be truly called a remnant of the land that then was? The whole country is only a long promontory extending far into the sea away from the rest of the continent, while a surrounding basin of the sea is everywhere deep in the neighborhood of the shore. Many great deluges have taken place during the 9,000 years, for that is the number of years which have elapsed since the time of which I am speaking. And during all this time, and through so many changes, there has never been any considerable accumulation of the soil coming down from the mountains, as in other places, but the earth has fallen away all round and has sunk out of sight. The consequence is that in comparison of what then was, there are remaining only the bones of the wasted body, as they may be called, as in the case of small islands, all the richer and softer parts of the soil having fallen away, and the mere skeleton of the land being left. But in the primitive state of the country, its mountains were high hills covered with soil, and the plains, as they are termed by us, of Phelleus, were full of rich earth, and there was abundance of wood in the mountains. Of this last, the traces still remain, for although some of the mountains now only afford sustenance to bees, not so very long ago there were still to be seen roofs of timber cut from trees growing there, which were of a size sufficient to cover the largest houses. And there were many other high trees, cultivated by man and bearing abundance of food for cattle. Moreover, the land reaped the benefit of the annual rainfall, not as now losing the water which flows off the bare earth into the sea, but having an abundant supply in all places, and receiving it into herself and treasuring it up in the close clay soil. It lay off into the hollows the streams which it absorbed from the heights, providing everywhere abundant fountains and rivers, of which there may still be observed sacred memorials in places where fountains once existed. And this proves the truth of what I am saying. Such was the natural state of the country, which was cultivated, as we may well believe, by true husbandmen, who made husbandry the business, and were lovers of honor, and of a noble nature, and had a soil the best in the world, and abundance of water, and in the heaven above an excellently attempered climate. Now the city in those days was arranged for this wise. In the first place, the Acropolis was not as now, For the fact is that a single night of excessive rain washed away the earth and laid bare the rock. At the same time, there were earthquakes, and then occurred the extraordinary inundation, which was the third before the great destruction of Deucalion. But in primitive times, the hill of the Acropolis extended to the Eridanus and Elissus, and included the Nyx on one side and the Lycabettus as a boundary on the opposite side to the Nyx, and was all well covered with soil and level at the top, except in one or two places. Outside the Acropolis and under the sides of the hill there dwelt artisans, and such of the husbandmen as were tilling the ground near. The warrior class dwelt by themselves around the temples of Athene and Hephaestus at the summit, which moreover they had enclosed with a single fence like a garden of a single house. On the north side they had dwellings in common, and had erected halls for dining in winter, and had all the buildings which they needed for their common life, besides temples. But there was no adorning of them with gold and silver, for they made no use of these for any purpose. They took a middle course between meanness and ostentation, and built modest houses, in which they and their children's children grew old, and they handed them down to others who were like themselves, always the same. But in summertime, they left their gardens and gymnasia and dining halls, and then the southern side of the hill was made use of them for the same purpose. Where the Acropolis now is, there was a fountain, which was choked by the earthquake, and has left only the few small streams which still exist in the vicinity. But in those days the fountain gave an abundant supply of water for all and of suitable temperature in summer and in winter. This is how they dwelt, being the guardians of their own citizens and the leaders of the Hellenes, who were their willing followers, and they took care to preserve the same number of men and women through all time, being so many as were required for warlike purposes then as now, that is to say, about 20,000. Such were the ancient Athenians, and after this manner they righteously administered their own land and the rest of Hellas. They were renowned all over Europe and Asia for the beauty of their persons and for the many virtues of their souls. And of all men who lived in those days, they were the most illustrious. And next, if I have not forgotten what I heard when I was a child, I will impart to you the character and origin of their adversaries. For friends should not keep their stories to themselves, but have them in common. Yet, before proceeding further in the narrative, I ought to warn you that you must not be surprised if you should perhaps hear Hellenic names given to foreigners. I will tell you the reason of this. Solon, who was intending to use the tale for his poem, inquired into the meaning of the names and found that the early Egyptians, in writing them down, had translated them into their own language. And he recovered the meaning of the several names and, when copying them out, again translated them into our language. My great-grandfather, Drupides, had the original writing, which is still in my possession and was carefully studied by me when I was a child. Therefore, if you hear names such as are used in this country, you must not be surprised, for I have told you how they came to be introduced. The tale, which was of great length, began as follows. I have before remarked in speaking of the allotments of the gods that they distributed the whole earth into portions differing in extent, and made for themselves temples and instituted sacrifices. And Poseidon, receiving for his lot the island of Atlantis, begat children by a mortal woman, and settled them in a part of the island which I will describe. Looking towards the sea, but in the center of the whole island, there was a plain which is said to have been the fairest of all plains and very fertile. Near the plain again, and also in the center of the island at a distance of about 50 stadia, there was a mountain not very high on any side. In this mountain there dwelt one of the earth-born primeval men of that country, whose name was Evenor, and he had a wife named Leucippe, and they had an only daughter, who was called Cleto. The maiden had already reached womanhood when her father and mother died. Poseidon fell in love with her and had intercourse with her, and breaking the ground enclosed the hill in which she dwelt all round. making alternate zones of sea and land larger and smaller, encircling one another. There were two of land and three of water, which he turned as with a lathe, each having its circumference equidistant every way from the center, so that no man could get to the island, for ships and voyages were not as yet. He himself, being a god, found no difficulty in making special arrangements for the center island, bringing up two springs of water from beneath the earth, one of warm water and the other of cold, and making every variety of food to spring up abundantly from the soil. He also begat and brought up five pairs of twin male children, and dividing the island of Atlantis into 10 portions, he gave to the firstborn of the eldest pair his mother's dwelling and the surrounding allotment, which was the largest and best, and made him king over the rest. The others he made princes and gave them rule over many men and a large territory. And he named them all. The eldest, who was the first king, he named Atlas. And after him, the whole island and the ocean were called Atlantic. To his twin brother, who was born after him, and obtained, as his lot, the extremity of the island towards the Pillars of Heracles, facing the country which is now called the region of Gades, in that part of the world.
Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.